What makes the dual loyalty concept so tricky? Well, you've got your patient, and then you've also got your organization that you are a part of.
Well, it's the knowledge that your employer has got certain expectations on you. So your employer's goals and your player's goals are not always aligned, although often they are. And when they're aligned, sometimes that's as much problem as it is. So, for example, a player wants to win. The team wants to win. The player wants to play.
Welcome to the SASMA podcast, your source for the latest insights in sports medicine. Designed for healthcare professionals, we cover everything from injury prevention to athlete performance and mental health, helping you stay informed and excel in your field. Let's dive in.
Welcome to today's episode of the SASMA podcast, where we explore the complex and often challenging intersection between sports medicine and ethics. We're diving into a conversation that doesn't get enough airtime. How do clinicians balance their medical duties with the unique pressures of working in elite sport? Joining me for this discussion is someone whose career spans from pediatric infectious diseases to advising the National Football League, Emeritus Professor Ross McKinney. As a consultant to the NFL Players Association and a member of their Accountability and Care Committee, Ross brings a rare blend of academic insight and real-world sport governance. Also with us is Clint Redhead, a physiotherapist and the current general manager of medical of SA Rugby, whose work on the ground gives him first-hand experience navigating these dilemmas from an organizational level. I'm Dr. Janesh Kanda, a sports physician, and in this episode, we're unpacking the gray areas, team pressure, dual loyalty, and ethical decision-making through lived experience and reflection. So let's get into it. So firstly, Ross, your background is in pediatric infectious diseases. How did you get into the topic of sports medicine and ethics?
Okay, I got into this because in 2011, the National Football League, American football, signed a collective bargaining agreement that included a new committee called the Accountable Care Committee that was supposed to negotiate between the players and the NFL as to what was appropriate medical care. And so this Accountable Care Committee had three members, had four members from the NFL. Four members from the Players Association. And the head of the Players Association said he wanted a bioethicist on the players' side. And the chief medical officer for the union, for the NFL Players Association, Tom Mayer, had graduated from Duke. So he called the dean at Duke and said, "Do you have a bioethicist interested in sports?" And she said, "Well, we have a bioethicist, and I think he's interested in sports." And so all of a sudden, I found myself on the Accountable Care Committee negotiating with the NFL over how they should provide care. And at that point, the hot issue was concussions and what was appropriate in the care of concussions at a time where the data was very light. And where the NFL had, in fact, published articles saying concussions aren't really a problem. Players can go ahead and get right back in as soon as they're able to work. Clearly, they can go ahead and go back into the game. So they had published articles to that effect, and the players were a little bit more skeptical. So I was thrown into this fray, this committee, and it's a fascinating process. The article that I wrote in 2012 was a result of the thinking that went into working around that committee.
And you said this committee was started in 2011. So, what was there prior to 2011? Or was this something that they put in place because they saw the need that they needed to have a committee like this
They
put
needed to
together?
have a committee like that. They needed to because the NFL clearly was of the mindset that if a player can play, a player should play, and long-term consequences be damned. And the NFL Players Association said, "You know, we think there are long-term consequences to playing football that are not being appreciated and that should be an active consideration during the process of evaluating a player acutely." So that was what originally prompted the notion that we needed a separate committee that could negotiate between the NFL's point of view and the player's point of view.
And Ross, tell me, were you working on player by player cases, or were you looking at it more from a governance perspective in terms of putting forward protocols?
It was both. So There was a governance perspective. So if you look, if you follow the National Football League, they now have a bunch of changes that were implemented as a result of this committee. So for example, they now have a spotter in the booth who can kick a player out of the game if they see that they're looking like they had trauma. They require independent, not team or league paid, well, they're league paid, but they're independent neurologists on each side to determine whether a player can resume play or not. They empowered the referees to kick a player out of a game if they thought they were acting in some way like they'd had a head injury. So we empowered a bunch of ways to protect the players. What was interesting, that was the governance part. And then we looked at individual cases where there had been decisions made by a team physician to send a player back into play in what appeared to be an inappropriate situation. The most famous being the Tagliavua case in Miami, where, a player who'd had clearly had a concussion was put back into the game. And then shortly thereafter, next week, gets put back in again and never should have been put in. And what was the decision-making process? So we went through an evaluation of that decision-making process on an individual basis. But I think more important was the governance.
I just want to comment, it's quite interesting. That 2010, 2011, 2012 period was almost the tipping point, turning point for most contact sports. What Ross was doing with an NFL at that stage, Dr. Martin Raftery at World Rugby had started, and that became the, we started with the introduction of the pitch side concussion assessment program, which eventually is morphed and evolved into the HIA, the Head Injury Assessment Protocol. But with that, we always had match day doctors and referee rules and all that. But at that point in time, once the research was showing us evidence, what we needed to do and what we had been doing in the past wasn't necessarily as accurate as we should have done it. We enhanced the responsibilities of that match day doctor, the equivalent of the spotter, who has all those lateral authority and powers now to automatically remove a player from the game if he believes him to have suffered a concussion, sustained a concussion, or suspect a concussion, or even if he's got a debilitating leg injury that really you can see he's struggling to continue. The rules of the game also changed. So both sports, rugby wise and NFL, very, very important stage in sort of the history of the management and of athletes took place around about this the same time.
I can maybe ask a question on that because that's interesting. Would either of you know why specifically in that time frame there was such a push towards this in terms of rugby being the pitch side assessment in the NFL starting up this working group? Because I mean, by then already, by 2012, there would have probably been at least three iterations of the SCAT. So concussion work was quite far down the line. So would you guys have any idea why in 2012 it would have hit this head?
I'll have to look back at when the first cases of CTE were described, but I think it was the awareness that CTE was a potential outcome or something like that, that long-term neurologic outcomes did occur in players at a higher rate. And around that time, the NFL Players Association began funding research to look at long-term player outcomes that could provide data that could substantiate decisions made about how to manage players during the course of their career.
Janesh, from a rugby side, ours was slightly different to Ross's side. Ross and them, if we think about it, the NFL concussion lawsuit case that eventually went to settlement sort of all broke around that 2013, 2014, 2015 time. The Will Smith movie Concussion just Hollywood highlighted the NFL concussion sort of problem. So I see where Ross came in. The rugby, what happened with rugby was is that obviously like NFL rugby, yes, we had the two or three iterations of the SCAT. We were using the SCAT to manage concussion. However, at the 2011 World Cup, Rugby World Cup, Dr. Martin Rafferty was doing a bit of research, and what they found was is that, team doctors were given an average of 50 seconds or to make a decision of if a player had sustained a concussion on the field of play. So, and a lot of those players were then continued playing and were diagnosed with having sustained a concussion after the match. So what Dr. Martin Raftery decided to do was we needed to intervene with an intervention that allowed the match day doctor or the team doctor more time to make a call on whether the player has a concussion or confirmed concussion, and then remove that player either for a review or, in the case of a criteria one confirmed concussion, remove him altogether. And that's where the evolution of the pitch side concussion assessment, HIA, head injury assessment protocols were born in rugby. It all came from that 2011 period. It more came from the way we were having the time doctors had to make a decision on concussion, not so much how we were managing them afterwards, because there was the assumption that was made that because of the scats, because of that, remember at those stages, there was still the 3-week stand down rule. Because of those rules, if a player had a concussion, they would be managed appropriately. They just weren't being identified immediately at the time of the injury.
Yeah, 100%. And Clint, just moving over to you, obviously in rugby union, I mean, how does this topic impact you, sports medicine and ethics? How does it impact you as a GM medical at SA Rugby?
So if I put my general manager medical on hat on at SA Rugby, I'm all about governance and reducing and mitigating risk. And that risk is also, a lot of it is legal risk. So of course I wear a big player welfare hat, and of course that drives almost all what we do. But from a general manager perspective, I've got to worry about the governance and the legality all around risk. So ethics is very important to me because, you know, we deal with on paper in principle, the idea of being ethical and making a decision and the player can't play and therefore must rest it sounds all very simple and easy to do. However, on the ground, it's very nuanced. And you've almost got to understand all those nuances. You've got to understand the framework that sits around these ethical decisions. And then you've got to build that individual case within that framework. And then you make your decisions. And I'm positive Ross can elaborate way better than I can on that. But that's the lessons that I've learned over time, that one set of decision-making rules on one player may not be the same for another player. Because we might say a player has the autonomy to make a decision. However, in the case of a concussion where I know that the decision of the player to decide to play on by him, to continue to play because he wants to, that can have really detrimental effects. Therefore, my team doctor and my match day doctor may have more power than the player's autonomy to make that decision. But that's a nuanced case where if a player maybe breaks the tip of his finger and we can strap those fingers and it's a bit sore and the player decides I'm going to play, that's a different ethical decision. So I think the it's very individual to the situation and the case. I don't know what you think, Ross. You probably read way more than I have around this. But
well, it's an incredible conundrum because the players are very, very competitive people. They want to play. They do not want to let their teammates down. They do not want to let their team down. You know, they basically want to get back into the game at a fairly high degree of certainty. They want to be back in there. But often they're not in a position of making a good decision. You know, they just had their head, you know, slammed against somebody else's helmet. And they're not in a good position to be making a decision. So how do you make a judgment about that player's autonomy, their right to make a decision, their right to accept a certain amount of risk at a point at which they cannot actually assess their own risk very well, but they want to. So, you know, you have to give the manager, the physician, the person who's managing the concussion, a fair bit of authority, because the player autonomy may not be in the best interest of the player. And we don't normally like to override autonomy, people's right to make decisions about their own medical care. But this is one of those situations where it's probably acceptable to do that, to let somebody else make the decision that the person isn't able to go back into the game when they would like to because of the risk that they may be inflicting on themselves.
So Ross, what is quite interesting as well, and you would have seen this in NFL and definitely in rugby union, and I know it's there in rugby league, especially with the diagnosis or the injury of concussion, the sport have now set down rules and have actually removed the autonomy decision-making from the player. It is a rule. If you meet these thresholds, you will be removed. You will stand down for a certain period of time and you will follow a certain individualized pathway before you return to play. So that's quite interesting, Ross, in terms of this whole concept of ethics. You know, we then have certain conditions where the sport has now introduced rules and we remove that autonomy, the autonomy from the player in making that decision because the sport has made those decisions.
But as you say, there's still nuance and there is
still
judgment. And the physician is still making judgments, and it's very hard to figure out, you know, how woozy is this player? You know, there are some players who are able to sound just like they normally do, even though their brain is not working very well, which may be a comment on the before. But the issue is you may not be able to judge fully what the level of injury is. Historically on those tests where, for example, they count backwards. Well, the players during the spring drills would count backwards slowly so that when it came time for them to be evaluated during the game, their slow performance was in fact matched to what they demonstrated in the spring, even though they could have done much better. They were sandbagging so that they'd be able to stay in the game when the time came. And so it's been a real challenge. Yeah, you can have hard and fast rules, but there's so much about concussion that is in the, it's like pain. You know, you really can't judge pain if you aren't the person experiencing the pain. It's the same kind of thing. There is an element of judgment that enters in that makes it harder to make good, clear decisions than you might expect from the rules.
Just an observation from my side is just that those decisions are tougher to make field side with concussion because of the rules that we have in place and the low threshold that we have for removing a player. That has helped. But, you know, if we remove ourselves from concussion and we take other injuries, a knee injury, an ankle injury, you know, if that player plays on that knee, will he set up potentially an ACL? How does it affect the performance of the team? The player wants to play, as Ross says, they don't want to let the team down. They want to play. Those decisions are difficult to make, challenging to make field side when that player wants to play. What I am finding at the very top end, the professional level, players are better at accepting that this is a career path so that now that I've sat down with the doctor, we've had the scan, my knee's at risk, I need it 4 or 5 weeks off. That doesn't mean to say he's ever going to lose his chance to be a professional rugby player again. His career continues. So they're better at making those decisions today than I think they were 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Where the challenge comes in, and I'm sure Ross will agree, is when you come down a level or two and you're not at the professional level, when it's that kid at college who's trying to make it to the pro ranks, so they'll take that risk, or the schoolboy at a Craven Week, trying to get into the SA school side or be picked up by a union for a junior contract. They make different decisions because of those outside influences. And we have to take those into consideration, the team physician, when making those calls. And back to Ross's point, with all that other influence, is the decision that the player makes truly one of autonomy that's been guided by the best advice, the best interests for the health of that player?
I was just going to say, you know, you look at a junior player who gets a reputation for being concussion prone. Well, they're worried they'll never get scholarship or picked up by the next level on the junior levels of the pros because I'm concussion prone. So they don't want that on their record if they possibly can. And you add in the fact that the level of people making the assessments are less skilled when you get to the lower levels than you are in the professional leagues where you have people who see it a lot. But you get the physicians are in the position of debating between the best interest of their employer, the team, versus the best interest of the player, the player's long-term arc versus the team's short-term needs. This particularly, where I saw this most often was in the playoffs, that the rules, the lines get really fuzzy during the playoffs, and players who probably shouldn't be playing are out there on the field because they'll take that short-term risk which is a real risk during the playoffs because the stakes are so high.
Janesh, just to support Ross on that, and I don't know if it happens as much today as it happened a while ago. Coaches used to be of the opinion of certain players that a player that who's only at 60%, who's only at 60% at his best because of carrying a niggle or an injury, is better than another player who could be at 100% fitness. Now, I must admit, like, I get that concept, but it doesn't work in looking after the health of the player. And inevitably, from the experience that I saw, it very rarely worked on the field because inevitably that player was concerned about their ability to perform properly. They either ended up breaking down anyway. I do think that it sort of reiterates what Ross was saying earlier, but I do think we are slowly moving past that. But I must say that at the lower levels, that still exists. You know, you've got the big schoolboy derby on the weekend. You know, player A could hardly walk after the injury, gets in the game the week before. However, you know, the team, everybody believes he should be playing. He's willing to take the risk, even though we know that he might make it worse. But also that from a performance perspective, he's probably not even going to perform. But as Ross said, around those games, the playoffs, the semifinals, the finals, those lines become extremely fuzzy and the clarity is not always there. And it takes to try and tie it back to a team physician. It takes a team physician, if they've got one, to be able to step back and clear their head and sort of be principled in saying, well, what am I here for? I'm here for player health and well-being. What is my clinical diagnosis and picture of this player? I don't believe he should be playing. Have I informed the player? Yes, I have. Have I heard what the player has to say? Yes, I have. Well, how are we going to get around that? Well, let's show the player, if we're really worried, let's show the player through a full fitness test 2 days before the game that you've got to go through everything that you're going to expect in a game at game pace. Can you even prepare yourself for that? Often they can't, and that helps to make the decision. So you have to think very, very sort of, you have to take yourself out of the emotion, out of the fan syndrome, and be the team physician and make a clear decision.
But making it even harder is your patient is who you are trying to serve. And your patient is telling you, I want you to serve me by getting me back in the game.
Janesh, and I've always said that, sorry, I've said this to you. So Ross, I'm going to declare something. I'm when Janesh wears his team physician hat for the Sevens, I'm his boss. But be that as it may, yes, the team physician should try what they can do to get the back, to get the player back. That is their skill. That's what they're there for. But they mustn't try and fool themselves if they can't. And then you have to have that tough conversation with the athlete eventually to say, you know what? We said we'll give it 48 hours. We've given it 48 hours. You're still not in the position to even take the practice field tomorrow and train at 100%. I cannot then sign you off for the match on Saturday because you're just not going to be good enough, or you're not ready enough, or you're going to do yourself a further injury, or you're going to let the team down because your performance won't be right. Where it gets fuzzy again, Ross, and I don't know if these practices are out there, but it's sort of when you do have a team physician who's prepared to go against the rules and maybe inject lignocaine for match day and numb the injured ankle. You know, that starts getting... That goes into those ethical questions again. And I suppose to your point, it's who do you answer to, the player or the team?
That fact, sometimes it's like the pain control. You know, you're answering to both. The player says, I want to play. Give me the pain control. You know, I'm ready. Give me the Toradol. I want to be on the field. And you're at the same time, you know, as a physician, you're setting them up for potential harm because that pain is actually a signal that something is injured or inflamed. And so why are you putting them back in that situation by giving them the pain med, which as it happens, that particular one has other side effects when it's used chronically. It is a really difficult issue to try and get at the right level because everybody has pain when you play professional. Everybody, and I'm sure the same is true in rugby. You know, it is a physical game that leads to pain, and you're going to have to play through it as part of the game. But when is that pain a signal of damage that really needs to be understood and protected rather than letting the player continue to play with the pain at a high risk of injury. And at least with joints, with bones and joints, you know, you're only going to end up with a replacement joint when you're 50 at worst. You can't replace the head. That's the trouble with the concussions.
Yeah, that's, and I think adding one more layer to that, Clint and Ross, is what happens when the player who you take through a testing, he says he's 95% ready, and you can't objectively say that he's not at 95%. So let's call it a hamstring injury, where often they can sprint through, run through, they can sort of mask it enough before getting onto the field. Get onto the field first 5 minutes in, they do a grade three hamstring on that same side. And again, I think that's what makes this entire conversation so great. At what point do you take a player's autonomy away? I think that's sort of what probably sums the issue up.
It is the hardest thing about this whole process. I mean, you are in a position, you're both a fan and you're an employee as the physician. And at the same time, you're trying to keep in mind what the long-term outcome for the player should be to protect that. At the same time that the player may be just asking you to protect their short-term outcome because they care more about their short-term outcome than their long-term outcome. And sort of who are you to decide that their long-term outcome is more important than their short-term outcome? Mm-hmm. And what injuries are ones where that decision matters? And with the head, I think we've generally got a consensus that the physician, we should be protecting the head, that the cognitive outcomes, which we have demonstrated are a problem, are significant enough that the players should be protected, that their short-term is not nearly as important as the long term. But with some things, you know, like strained muscles, ankle sprains, other sprains, maybe with some pain med, they could get through and not produce further damage. And if they do, it's not likely to be a long-term or career ending.
Just to confirm what Ross is saying there, I think there's general consensus around head, neck, and spine. I think nobody's going to argue there. But on everything else, there's a discussion to be had. And to go back to your hamstring scenario, there are a number of like conundrums there. First of all, there's the player's had a serious injury. He has passed as many of the tests as he can, though you still convinced he needs one more week as the team physician. So you have that discussion with the player, but the player says, but doc, I've passed all the tests. You then say, okay, then you got to do the other ethical thing as the team physician. You have a discussion with the team coach. Now, hopefully you've had the player sign consent that like his medical information, he can discuss with the team coach because it affects the potential outcome of how he picks his team and maybe the outcome on the day. You have the discussion with the coach and you say to the coach, coach, player's career, player's fine, passed all the tests, but I still believe he needs one more week. However, the player is 100% convinced he's good to go. Maybe then the coach feels, well, I'm ready to have that. Let's take that risk. Player gets through the game, fantastic. 5 minutes into the game, player tears the hamstring really badly, going to be out for the next 6 weeks. Well, then I suppose all you can say is, I told you so. But the decision, the way I look at it is that the decision it was shared. But what happens in the scenario where the player tells you, doc, I don't want you to even tell the coach that I might not be ready. I want you to tell him I'm 100% ready. And then you tell the coach and the player breaks down. Now the coach loses faith in his doctor and in the player. So the other problems that then spin off from that is that, you know, the coach then says, well, can I trust the player anymore? Do I trust the doc? Where am I with this? Phew, very, very nuanced issues that sit around all these decisions we make.
And it's also true that in general, players have some skepticism about the team docs. At least that's what we've seen in the NFL. I mean, there are excellent team docs who have a persistent pattern of thinking about the player's welfare first. And when the players perceive their physician is thinking first about their welfare, they will trust them. If the players perceive that this is just an employed physician doing what the team wants, then nobody is served well.
That's a good point you make, Ross. And I do believe that's why at the end of the day, I think, and Janesh, I think you did ask me once about what advice would you give a young physician. I think from the very beginning to follow what Ross had just said there, your first foremost principle must be to the player's health and well-being. Because once the player understands that, they will trust you. They will always try and push the boundary. Players do that. That's what they prime to do that.
How they got
but
there.
But if you turn around and because he trusts you, or they, if you turn around, they will then say, listen, okay, doc, if you don't think I should play, I won't play. So I do think what Ross says is very important.
I think that's exactly it, Eklund, is that if we as the team physicians act ethically, intuitively, I think our players would trust us more, or at least let's say the 95% would trust us more. There's always going to be the outliers on either side that potentially wouldn't. And I think that is the only way when you're working in the team setup that you can actually navigate this. It's just intuitively to act within the ethical boundaries. But that leads me to my next question. And I'd like to actually get both of your opinions on this. The traditional ethical model, and we've obviously chatted a little bit about the autonomy and removing autonomy and when is true autonomy actually true autonomy? Should the regular medical ethical model be applicable within a sports medicine setting, specifically within a team setting?
I think if the ethical model says serve my patient, that's my highest priority. I will maintain confidence, but there's always the need to communicate. Like, for example, if I need to talk to the neurosurgeon, then, you know, there's an understanding from the physician that I will be talking to the neurosurgeon. So I will operate in communications that are within the traditional boundaries. And my first priority is the patient, not the team. As long as you can keep that in mind, then I think that the traditional ethics make sense. It is, however, important to always be aware of the pressures that come from being in that dual role of a team employee and a advocate for the patient. Just your professionalism should put patients first.
Janesh, keep in mind that at the end of the day, you're a medical professional, a team physician. You're bound by the oath to do no harm and look after your patient. You're also bound by the ethical rules of your health professions council that you belong to. So whether you want to have the ethical model in place or not, you're bound by it. So accept it. And then, as Ross said, Ross alluded to it, but I said the same thing in a note I made. Yeah, I just said, make peace with the fact that you are the medical professional, and you are going to have very challenging times in the role. You know, you're going to basically have different opinions on the health versus performance issues, on the fact that you're a medical doctor and they're a coach, on the fact that you have factual or clinical evidence versus emotion. You're going to have all this playing all the time. If you enter into the position as a team physician, make peace with the fact that that is going to be your life. It's not going to be just smooth sailing, easy decision making. You're going to be challenged all the time. And I think if you have that mindset and the fact that it's patient or player first, and that you must do no harm, you've got to be there for the well-being of the player. I think if that's your overarching position, I think you then start making clearer decisions with taking all the everybody's input in and listening to the player and specialists, but you'll make a better decision for that player.
The other thing I would say is important is that in those decisions that are made in the moment, that are made by physicians to allow a player to continue to play, they need to be reviewed. After the game is done, after the week is over, peers should at some point kind of review and say, that was a good, there was problems with that decision. And in fact, there is a significant amount of review in the NFL decision-making tree to make sure that there are not, people are making good decisions, not decisions that favor one side or the other in an inappropriate way.
And Janesh, just to, from a rugby's perspective, rugby via the head injury assessment protocol has got the independent reviewer. So you know after every match, there's a match doctor, all the video clips regarding the head injuries are sent through to that an independent reviewer with all the notes. And that independent reviewer then looks at each case and just says, was best practice applied here? If it wasn't, what lessons could we learn? And then go back to that team for set of team physicians and say, listen, this is what we picked up. This is what we can learn. This is what we should do better in future. So that
exactly.
process is in place.
And I think that's, Clint, that's empowering for the team physician to know that there is a second almost safety net, that these decisions are being reviewed. Because as a team physician on the side of the field, you've got about 50 seconds to make a good decision. And obviously within rugby, we've now got the World Rugby course, and that upskills us to the point where it does make it easier to make those decisions. But at least in having these safety nets, it allows us to act ethically. And it shouldn't be really seen as something that's policed. It's more actually just to empower us as the guys on the side of the field. And Ross, you sort of alluded to it a little bit earlier in terms of the dual loyalty concept. What makes the dual loyalty concept so tricky? You've got your patient, and then you've also got your organization that you are a part of.
Well, it's the knowledge that your employer has got certain expectations on you. So your employer's goals and your player's goals are not always aligned, although often they are. And when they're aligned, sometimes that's as much problem as it is. So, for example, a player wants to win. The team wants to win. The player wants to play. The team physician is making decisions about the player and needs to be aware the other pressures are there that could make them make decisions tilted towards the team's desire to have this player play that may not be in the best interest of the player. So you have to be constantly thinking about, and the trouble is you don't even know because it's just within yourself. Am I overweighted towards the team? Am I overweighted towards the player? It's always safer to be weighted most heavily towards the player's long-term outcome. That's the safest position to be in. But you're almost always getting some pressure to let the player play when you may not think they're quite ready. You are always getting that message subliminally or overtly.
So Janesh, also just my 2 cents on that matter is just that at SA Rugby, you would know, and a number of years ago, we reached out to a legal department about legal advice on this, and we removed the fact that you were employed. At the end of the day, you were always paid by SA Rugby, but your employment was removed from having a contract with a team. You were employed independently to the organization. And that contract was set up in such a way that you were given full autonomy. You know, your decision was binding, and that's how those contracts were set up. And I think that went a long way to, and then on top of that, you reported into the general manager of medical. You didn't report into anybody else. And that goes a long way to sort of give the team physician a sense of almost security that they are making a medical decision in the best interests of the player. Yes, it may not be in the best interest of the team, but it's in the best interest of the player. I'm not going to be negatively affected because I'm not making the decision the team wants. And also, because I'm making a decision and I'm reporting into my general manager of medical, who's a medical professional bound by the Health Professions Council as well, I support that decision. So there's support along the way. So you may not always be popular, but you're making the correct decision. And the other thing I always tell the doctors that work for me and the physios that work for me, and I mean it in the nicest sense of the way, but you're not the player's friend. You're his team physician. You're there to make medical decisions for him, not make decisions like a mate would make. So, you know, if you've got to remove yourself from that mindset, and that helps a lot as well. And then, you know, sometimes you've got to be comfortable with the fact that you're not going to be the popular person. You're not making the popular decision. You're making the decision nobody wants to hear, even though most people at the end of the day will realize it's the right decision. And I think you've got to make peace with all of that as the team physician, team medic.
Yeah, there's always that pressure. And since it sounds like you took care of that particular issue, but you know that if I am too player centric, the team will fire me because you know I'm not doing enough to keep the players on the field. I'm doing things that are perceived to be I'm letting them be slackers. And most of them are not slackers. This is not the way it works. But that, you know, you are worried that you are as a team physician that you could lose your job if you aren't doing enough to keep them on the field, even when it wasn't in their best interest. So having your contract structure is a good idea.
And Ross, I was going to say that in our setting, it's almost the doctor is too conservative in terms of how he manages the players because you're pushing for a longer return to play, and the coach is saying, "Well, can't we get him back 4 weeks earlier?" And if you don't, then you're the conservative one. And like Clint said, you become the unpopular one. And Clint, that's actually something, I mean, Ross, I've called Clint many a times with multiple issues. And as he's talking about it now, you do realize that in the way that that was structured, it actually made so much sense. Because at any point with me being on the ground, if I had a challenging scenario, it was never, let me go to the coach and chat to the coach. It was always, okay, let me give him a call and get advice from there. So I think it was a soundboard again to have, just to remind yourself again, you acting ethically. Clint, you were obviously on the side of the field. Did you have any challenging moments where you did have a question around your loyalty in your time as a physio?
No, man, I think there are two reasons why. Fortunately enough, within all the professional teams I worked in, I always had a team physician with me. So the decision making was, we made the decision together. There were never ever thought, sure, if I don't make this decision the right one, SA Rugby is going to be upset with me. I always thought about, how is my athlete presenting to me right now on the field? Is there a quick test I can do to check the integrity maybe of that knee joint, of that medial collateral ligament? Yes, there is, quickly tested. Is that positive or negative? It's negative. Okay, let's get the player up. Let's see if they can run. Okay, they can run. Let's watch him for 5 minutes. We'll make a call. I think those are the things that most team physicians, team medics do. So I wasn't ever challenged. I didn't really feel challenged for dual loyalty on the side of the field. I also was very fortunate though, Janesh, for my final four years with the Springboks. I worked with a very good doctor, Dr. Yusuf Hassan, and Yusuf was very ethically bound. And Yusuf didn't care with what the coach ever thought or what the organization thought. His duty was 100% to the player. And I remember going to World Cup. At the time, he withdrew probably, I won't mention the names, but probably one of our biggest weapons that we would have had. And Yusuf made the most unpopular decision to withdraw him. Why? Because that was the right medical decision to make at the time. Yes, the player eventually went on and played rugby and played more tests for the Springboks. But the difficult call was made in the player's best interests going to the World Cup. This is what players want to go to. Coaches want the best players in the world to be at these tournaments. And the team doctor made that unpopular decision. And it wasn't popular. And he got lots of flack and flack in the press. And other unions, other doctors coming back and saying, no, but you've got it wrong. This is it. But he trusted his specialists and made that call. So, yes, I think I had good people around me that I learned from. And that's another probably pearl of wisdom that a young physician can take. You know, Ross has passed a good couple ones on already, but, you know, always surround yourself with people that you trust to talk to and people that have sort of had some experience in the space already. Doesn't mean to say they're going to have the right answers, but they may help your thinking become a little bit more clearer as well.
Yeah, no, thanks, Clint. That is a team. I actually saw a post on, I think it was LinkedIn, where they talked about team doctors working quite an isolated setting because you're sort of the team doctor and you're making these decisions for these players and often as a head of medical. And I actually read that and I realized that I think one of the most important things about being a team physician is actually not working in isolation. It's taking feedback from your team physio, taking feedback from your specialist and using all of that. And again, I guess that talks to the ethical question that we have, because if you take all these opinions in, you probably are acting in the best interest of the player or the patient just by reaching out to so many professionals to be able to make a very informed decision going forward.
If you just, You know, and it's one of those things that the concept of medico-legal risk, I build it into this decision-making process because at the end of the day, if you've got a team physician in a team, but you've got a physiotherapist and a strength and conditioning coach and a fitness trainer, and you've got all, at the end of the day, medico-legally, the team physician still takes the brunt of the decision made. So yes, I always say it's a player-centered approach with medical professionals around that player, and they all discuss, and in their scope of expertise, they bring their expertise to the table to make that decision. It's a collective decision made, but you as the team physician have got to be happy that that decision has been collectively made and you're happy and the player is happy where they are. And then you can sign off on that. And that protects you medico-legally. If you have the team physician, but the physio signs the player off without the consulting you or consulting anyone else and something goes wrong, and that player's agent wants to take you on legally, well, you didn't make that call. The physio did. But there wasn't that cohesive model, that cohesive team around the player. But at the end of the day, and in my teams, I might be wrong, Ross, but in my teams, in my environment, I always put the team physician at the top of the pyramid. The buck stops with him. Or who?
I think that's pretty much the model that professional sports use. There is a team physician. And the trick is the team picks the team physician on their ability to protect their players, or do they pick their team physician on their ability to keep them on the field, even at some cost? And in fact, I'm afraid that there are teams that clearly pick their team physicians on the second criteria. This is a guy who's going to let my players play. I want my players to play. As opposed to, this is a guy or gal who is going to be protecting my players first. And there are some owners and some managers who get that and who hire physicians whose priorities are well aligned with what I think is best appropriate for professional physicians and physios. I mean, there are some teams that hire not for that, but hire for the keeping the player on the field aspect, which is not in the best interest of players.
Thanks, Ross and Clint. I think just in closing, what advice, and Clint, you obviously mentioned it, I think both of you have mentioned a few very good pieces of advice to younger sports physicians, physios, younger practitioners getting into the field. What pieces of advice would you give them as they're entering into the team environment to ensure that they're acting ethically in their work?
I think good mentors matter. I think some mentors having sounding boards.
So, I mean, and Janesh, I think it's the obvious one, but it's a difficult one in the beginning for a young physician to understand. You're not the fan, you're the team physician. Okay. You have to take a step back when it's all crazy, when it's spinning out because we're going to lose player X and player X is important to the team. You've got to take a step back and you've got to take a deep breath. You've got to say to yourself, I'm going to review this player and make a decision in the best interest of the health of the player. So it's just clear thinking around that. And then have your processes, go through the process, talk to the player the whole time about what you're doing, so that at the end of the day, the player feels they part and parcel of the decision-making process, that it's a shared process. And as Ross says, surround yourself with a good network of people that you can bounce things off. And then at the end of the day, make peace with the fact that you are going to have to make difficult decisions that are not popular, but that's your job. And I think if you have that clear in mind going into the job, you won't be caught off guard. And you won't lie awake at night thinking, how do I tell the player and the coach tomorrow he can't play? Because you've already made peace with the fact going into the job that those are the decisions you're going to have to make.
Well, thank you both so much for your input around what is such a challenging and complex topic. I really appreciate both of your times. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Cheers.
Thank you.